Here and now, in a moment, our conversation today about the Internet. Are we changed by it? Well, it depends on who you mean by we. But first, on one side of New Orleans today, a mayor rang bells. On the other, a president held a moment of silence, perhaps a symbol of different views of the city 2 years after 1,600 people died in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. President Bush spoke at a charter school saying New Orleans is coming back, but hurdles remain.
We fully understand that New Orleans can't be rebuilt until there's confidence in the levees. It's one thing to plan, it's another thing to convince people that that the levees will work.
Richard Fawcett is in New Orleans for the Los Angeles Times. Richard, the president's remarks today were hopeful, upbeat. He talked about reforming education, building confidence in the levee system. But you write about a confused sense of how to assess the city, you know, progress alongside stagnation. Give us an example.
Well, sure, Robin. Maybe the best way to illustrate the issue in New Orleans is to sort of set this tableau in the Upper Ninth Ward, right near the Industrial Canal. On a little side street there, the Habitat for Humanity organization and volunteers from all across the country have come in and have built dozens of bright, beautiful, modest new clapboard homes painted in Caribbean colors. For local musicians, this idea was started up by Branford Marsalis and others, and it's in fact working. When it's done in a few months, more than 75% of the people living in there will be musicians, and musicians who don't make a lot of money in New Orleans tend to need this kind of housing.
But this is alongside what?
This is alongside just the scene across the street, which is that many of those houses still look bombed out, and if you look just across the Industrial Canal, nature is reclaiming the lower Ninth Ward, where blocks upon blocks almost look like the bayou.
Mm. Well, and we read 274,000 residents are back in New Orleans, but that's out of 455. So is that, as you write, a reason to cheer or a sign that a city is halved? A 73% citywide increase in burglaries. And one of the complaints we're hearing is that federal aid money isn't getting to people who need it. You know, pretty stark numbers today. So what are people saying about today? I'm imagining there's conflicting emotions about politicians coming to town, but...
Well, there are, and I mean, it's the fact that the federal aid isn't coming is a complex issue. The federal government hired a company in Fairfax, Virginia called ICF International. I'm sorry, this is actually the state of Louisiana hired this company to dole out the federal aid. And there have been complaints that they've acted slowly, that they've paid too much money to their lawyers, that they've undervalued houses. About a little less than a quarter of the 180-something thousand people who've asked for federal aid have received it. And what you find on the ground is that people are, you know, anecdotally and non-scientifically, what I'm finding is that people are just starting to get their checks, or they're just starting to get their notice that they're going to get their checks. So you have, but this is long after the storm.
Yeah.
And as one contractor told me, it takes 40 days basically to fix up a modest New Orleans house.
Right.
So people have waited for a year. So there's sort of this mix of hope and anger and frustration.
Richard Fawcett in New Orleans for the Los Angeles Times. Richard, thank you.
Thanks.
Well, a coalition of activists plan to march from where the levee breached in the lower Ninth Ward to Congo Square in New Orleans this morning. As they gathered, we reached community activist Pam Dashiel on her cell phone in the lower Ninth Ward. She's president of the Holy Cross Neighborhood Association in the lower Ninth, a native of Roxbury, Massachusetts, who's lived in New Orleans for 23 years. I asked her what message she wanted to send.
That we are back. We are rebuilding, that we need the federal government to do its job. And I don't know that I'd call it a protest, but I mean, I would call it an affirmative initiative.
You talk about something called the right of return for New Orleans residents. The right of return. What do you mean by that?
To me, that means that everyone who was displaced because of federal incompetence, negligence, intentional or not intentional, needs to be able to have the resources. Some of us have resources, some of us don't. People have varying degrees of resources, but we need to be able to return here. There are many, many people, most of my neighbors are displaced. and dispersed throughout the country. The right of return is just that.
Well, Pam, we're going to let you go because it is a pretty active scene there. But I just want to ask, what would you say to people who say, but maybe you can't return to some places in the Ninth Ward? They're not safe. They maybe shouldn't have been built in the first place. We need to restore wetlands, for instance.
I would say we are building smarter, stronger, higher, and in appropriate locations, in locations that can withstand, and we are building to withstand. We are very cognizant of all our vulnerabilities. We know what the issues are, and we are meeting those challenges, and we will rebuild, and we're going to be as sustainable and resilient as possible.
Pam DeShiel, president of the Holy Cross Neighborhood Association in the Lower Ninth Ward, in a large group of New Orleanians out today. Pam, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, remember back a mere 10 years ago, there was this new thing that was going to change the world by connecting us all. The Internet will affect civilization as profoundly as the invention of printing, is how scholar and web innovator Peter Magnuson put it in 1997. So, has it? We're checking in on how the world is different or not with Ethan Zuckerman. He's a research fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. He's also co-founder of a company called Global Voices, an online resource for media from around the world. So, Ethan, what's your answer? Has the Internet lived up to the hype?
I'm not sure anything could live up to some of the hype at the peak of the Web 1.0 bubble. But I think at the same time, it's important to realize we've crested an amazing mark. We now have more than a billion people online. We certainly have the possibility to hold a conversation online that's broader or more inclusive than really anyone's held a conversation in history. The open question is whether we actually choose to engage in that question.
And who is this we were talking about? Who is getting to use the Internet? So let's address all these questions. First of all, you say people don't even mean the same thing when they say they're online, those billion people. What's the difference?
Compared to the United States, where 70% of people who are online at home are online via broadband, that number is even bigger in Europe. Much of my work has been in West Africa, where being online means you can get down to a cyber cafe once or twice a week.
Right.
That's a real different thing from being able to watch TV shows via YouTube.
And there's also an age distinction. If you're, well, you say 20s and up, it's sort of email, but then how are younger people using it?
A lot of the younger people who are online nowadays really see the web as being about instant messaging. Email is much more a tool used by authority figures. It isn't the tool that you use with your friends. This is based on research done by my colleague Dana Boyd. And Dana observes that teenage users nowadays are really sort of replicating their offline social networks online. That's a bit different from how the net was for the sort of pioneering users who generally went online to find a common topic to discuss. And so someone who was interested in photography might be interacting with someone from a different nation, but who had a common interest.
Well, I was going to ask about that because that was going to be the hope. There was this sense of the whole, you know, the world, parts of the world talking to each other. And it sounds as if the way, in particular, the younger people who are maybe online more often, the way they're using it is to just replicate the conversations they are having with the people they know.
Well, I think that's right. I think that the early cyber utopians, when they were getting online in the early 90s or maybe the late 80s, it was actually quite an international space. There was a certain assumption that technical topics would be of mutual interest. But now we're at the point we've got well over a billion users worldwide. You can't assume that English is a common topic. You can't assume any sort of common interests. So a lot of those social assumptions no longer have any bearing.
Yeah.
You really have to build your friendships, build your relationships, either based on bringing those offline relationships online or by very consciously deciding to build new relationships.
Well, and you write that you are now convinced that technology transfer is much more complicated than just bringing tools to people who didn't have them before.
A lot of this is based on work that I did with the last organization I worked on called Geek Corps.
Geek Corps.
So inspired by friends who'd worked with the Peace Corps, but wanting to take people who are working in the technology industry and letting them use their skills on the ground in sub-Saharan Africa and Central Asia and the Middle East. What we discovered was that it wasn't very hard to train geeks in other countries on how to use the technology. But business practices, cultural practices, the whole larger environment of how you run a business, how you run a technology company in these other countries gets much, much more complicated. Anyone who thinks that technology transfer is just about technology probably hasn't done much work in that field.
Well, and yet, on the other hand, help us understand this, because on the other hand, you also write a fascinating op-ed piece recently in the Boston Globe about how technology can be a part of, I think it was called incremental...
The theory that I was putting forth in that Boston Globe piece, I was calling incremental infrastructure.
Right.
And the idea was that countries at this point, many developing nations, are pretty desperate to develop the systems they need to connect internationally. And there are certain types of technology that seem to do very, very well deployed in the developing world. They tend to be technology that isn't tremendously expensive to implement, doesn't have to be implemented nationwide at the same time. It's atomic. A little bit of it will let you get ahead.
For instance, somebody, and so you write about someone who would build one cell tower, and then people would buy cell phones, and those cell phones that they bought would, that investment would pay for him to build another cell tower, and one at a time, he could suddenly have a network.
Right. That was a great example of Aliou Kanté's work in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where he moved into a nation that was literally at war, but figured out that even building a mobile phone tower in Kinshasa had a great deal of value just for people who were in Kinshasa. With the profits from that, was able to sort of build out the network. We've seen the same thing around internet technology. We've seen a lot of companies start up internet service providers that are really little more than a couple of computers and a satellite dish for a connection to the internet. But people are willing to pay to use that infrastructure. And in doing so, they finance the expansion of that infrastructure.
So back to your other thoughts. So why isn't it easy to bring this technology to these third world countries?
I think we assume that tools are going to be used a particular way. Blogging and citizen media is a sort of a great example of this. It wasn't clear that weblogs, for instance, would become a space for organizing political rallies, as they have in Egypt, where there's not a great deal of other space in the media. Mobile phones have become profoundly political devices in countries where there's a lot of fear of people assembling in person. Text messages have been illegal in Ethiopia since 2005, when text messages were used to organize an anti-government rally.
So what are you saying? Without a democracy, this kind of the use of the internet is tamped down or flourishes? I'm not sure.
I think we're in a moment of historical flux. What tends to happen is that when there isn't much space for democratic discourse in a society, people move towards whatever new technology makes it possible. Authorities who want to control speech start going after that medium as well. We just saw a fun example of this in Fiji, where the military government discovered that it was being criticized quite openly on blogs. And then we heard stories of the military government arresting people on suspicion of being a blogger. And this turned into a bit of a political scandal, and eventually the government backed down.
That's Harvard internet researcher Ethan Zuckerman. We'll hear more from Ethan. And in about 15 minutes, an American teenager who used the internet, Facebook to be exact, to try to save Darfur, the international applications. Back after the break, here and now. And now, and we're taking stock of the internet today. 10 years ago, it was called the new thing. It was going to change everything by making the world one connected village. Ethan Zuckerman is research fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard, co-founder of Global Voices, an online resource center gathering and translating the world's media. Ethan, we were just talking about how in many parts of the world, the internet and technologies like text messaging are being used to subvert government control of information. The situation seems slightly different in the U.S., where bloggers have been gaining acceptance as legitimate journalists admitted to courtrooms or party conventions. But you write something we've heard other people say, that one of the problems with blogging in the U.S. is that bloggers are often just cycling back what mainstream journalists report. You know, bloggers may amplify it, but you say, without a mainstream press, bloggers are like an amplifier without a guitar.
And I think that's true for most developed world bloggers. They're getting the news and then they're doing a commentary layer on top of it. It's a bit different in a developing world context. In many cases, bloggers there are giving us access to stories that we otherwise wouldn't hear about. And there the goal is to get a local story the sort of international attention that they believe it needs.
Well, and that brings us to what I think I'm reading is your biggest question mark over the whole question that we began with, has the internet changed the world? If I can't understand what this blogger is trying to tell me from a country in Africa, it may be the most impassioned plea, it may be the most important story, there may be something, but if I can't understand his language, it isn't working.
Beyond that, that blogger may be commenting on a very important local situation. If you don't have context to understand what she or he is talking about, you're probably not going to find it interesting. This is the challenge that we end up wrestling with over at Global Voices. Not only do we have to figure out what stories around the world might be interesting to a global audience, we have to translate them into English and then from English into other languages, but we also have to add sufficient context around them so that you can understand, you know, why it's important that this Egyptian blogger has been arrested for defamation and what those implications are for the rest of the country and for the local politics.
And this is what you do at Global Voices. This is a blatant plug for Global Voices. But it sounds as if that's the stumbling block to the dream of the internet being this worldwide sea change, more than it already is.
I think there's at least two stumbling blocks. One stumbling block comes up once you decide you're interested in finding out what people have to say in Cambodia. Then we can take on the challenges of how do we translate from Khmer to English? How do we give you the context around it? How do we find you the stories that you might be interested in? There's, in my mind, an even bigger stumbling block, which is how do you decide that Cambodia is important to you and that you want to pay attention to this?
So, again, we started by asking, has the internet lived up to the hype, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread or at least the printing press? Do you see it just being something that, again, a small group of elite people with your technical prowess and interest in a foreign country use to its full capacity and everybody else just sort of chatting with each other like a glamorized, telephone? Or do you see something more?
I'm pretty hopeful. I just think that we have to be realistic about the hype and the projections associated with hype. When you talk to young Africans, they are really interested in speaking back to European and American audiences, and they see the internet as their chance to have that conversation. As we get beyond 1 billion users to 2, 3, 4 billion users, as we see projects like One Laptop Per Child start putting very powerful generative devices into the hands of schoolchildren in developing nations, that conversation is going to change. We're going to be forced to encounter more and more voices actually coming from the developing world. It's going to be much harder to speak on behalf of people around the world because those people are going to look for opportunities to speak directly to us.
What you just said sounded so noble and very hopeful, but I can also hear people saying, oh, it's like spreading McDonald's around the country, only it's coming through a laptop. You know, it's about conversation, but it's also about seeing different cultures and maybe having it obliterate your own.
That's happening anyway. You go into rural Rwanda and you can see Sylvester Stallone movies, you know, in the middle of the jungle. What's so exciting about the internet is that it is by its nature a participatory two-way medium. The internet gives a chance that we're going to have that message going in both ways, that you can hear from Nigeria rather than broadcasting the signal to Nigeria.
And hear and see Nigeria's culture.
And hear and see Nollywood, which now, you know, is producing more films every year than Hollywood.
Nollywood?
Nollywood is the Lagos-based film industry, which produces hundreds of films a year, generally speaking, for audiences that live on about a dollar a day. It's a very, very different picture of the world than you're likely to get out of a Hollywood film. It's really inspired by the success of Bollywood, the Bombay film industry. But Nollywood has now become an international powerhouse. It will be very interesting to see what other aspects of African culture, Central Asian culture, South Asian culture, we all get to encounter more of once we start overcoming some of these digital divide issues in these parts of the world.
We live in a free market-driven world. I mean, doesn't somebody have to be able to make some money in order to be moved to do the kind of work that you're talking about?
I think there's immense market opportunity available in the developing world right now. And I think that the U.S. is actually very poorly positioned to take advantage of those opportunities because, for the most part, we're so ignorant about the opportunities in those markets. I think there's a real economic incentive and a real economic reason to start paying attention to news from these parts of the world.
Ethan Zuckerman, again, a research fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard and co-founder of the company Global Voices, which is trying to filter through all the world's news services and culture and information and translate it into different languages. I'm just wondering, do you ever find yourself, you know, looking around as you walk? We're here in Boston, as you walk around Boston or Cambridge, and people are all a-Twitter about Paris Hilton or turning on the same game shows at 7:30 at night. And then you turn on your computer, I'm imagining, and you go all these places. You're nodding your head yes. Are you ever thinking, gosh, they're missing what I'm seeing?
I get pretty relentless about it. On my own personal blog, I spend an enormous amount of time trying to push people towards what I think is interesting globally.
And it's like you've got a window and no one else is, or fewer people are looking out it.
And certainly the impulse is to say, if you just come over here and look in this direction, just look at what you can see. It's really very different from what you're seeing right now.
Ethan, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, still to come today, why Israeli officials feel they have to close the door to more refugees from Darfur and a look at Darfur through the eyes of a privileged American teenager. That's all after the news, here and now. It's here and now. Israeli human rights groups are reacting to their country's decision to turn back about 50 African asylum seekers, most from Darfur, who crossed the border into Israel from Egypt. The issue is particularly contentious in a country founded on the principle of asylum from genocide. Eileen Prusher is with the Christian Science Monitor in Jerusalem. Eileen, what are Israeli officials saying about their decision?
Well, one of the problems, Robin, with this is that the decision seems to be kind of ad hoc. Essentially, about 50 refugees from Sudan have been coming in every day. One of the difficulties is some are coming from Darfur, some are coming from South Sudan, of course, all via Egypt. And Israeli policy seems to be trying to make a distinction between people who are coming from Darfur and therefore are refugees from genocide and people who are coming from other parts of Sudan who might be refugees from civil war and economic problems and other bad conditions. In a sense, it's very haphazard, and it's kind of caused an uproar. And as you mentioned, a lot of human rights groups are trying to challenge this in the Supreme Court. And it's really not clear yet which way this problem is going to go.
Well, we know that officials have said, according to your reporting, that they have many refugees that will stay and that they'll be safe in Egypt. But we understand civil rights groups are saying, no, they will be sent back to Darfur. Is that clear?
That much is not clear, and one of the other things that isn't clear is that the Egyptian officials have said that it's not going to accept people who've gone into Israel and are then sent back into Egypt. But we've certainly heard from different refugee groups I've spoken to, different policymakers, that there's a fear that if people got sent back to Darfur, back to Sudan in general, certainly their lives would be in danger. And this is kind of an unprecedented phenomenon. So there's a sort of a concern of wanting to help some people, but perhaps fear of not wanting to completely open the floodgates and say that Israel can accept as many refugees as want to come, being that it's a small country of 7 million people. So there really is a kind of, you know, moral and political crisis that's brewing over this in particular. And so it seems that the policy is kind of here and there and all over the place. And there isn't one central policy yet of what's going to be done on this issue.
Well, you say it's a moral and political question. Sounds like a practical one, too. You know, how much one country can do. Eileen Prusher, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Eileen, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, American activist Nick Anderson has just come back from Darfur. That's not all that unusual. Many activists have been to this troubled region in western Sudan, but Nick is 18. About a year ago, with another Massachusetts teen, Nick founded Dollars for Darfur, a national fundraising challenge for American high schoolers run mainly through the online social networking sites Facebook and MySpace. It's raised about $300,000. But Nick felt he needed to see the situation firsthand. So he's been youth ambassador for Oxfam America. He visited young people at the camps for internally displaced people in the region. And he's back and joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
Just tell me, I want to know right away, you spoke specifically to young people, teenagers, you know, your peers in Darfur. What did they say to you?
Well, I spoke to young people in various towns across Darfur, but the message was very unified, and they all want specific things so they can help to rebuild their communities. Training is the most important. Vocational training, they want technical skills like welding, electrical skills, construction skills, things like that, so they can be empowered to rebuild their communities, their homes, and go on with life. Mm. But of course, the overarching concern is a ceasefire and getting safety for these people and aid workers in the area. And those are really the main things that young people were asking for.
You also talked about how they were concerned about health issues, but not in the way we might think about them.
No, there's things like they're asking for spades and shovels. So, for example, I was talking to some young men from a secondary school class in a village called Kebkebia. They were talking about standing water pools that were outside their schoolyard, and these serve as a breeding ground for mosquitoes that can potentially carry dangerous and life-threatening diseases. So they just wanted shovels so they could fill in these water pools.
It sounds as if one of the things the young people are really saying is that they feel so passive. They have the youth, they have the desire to help, but there's nothing they can do.
Yeah, they really are a little bit frustrated in some senses because they have the energy and they really want to help. They just need the basic skills and tools to be able to help themselves, really.
Yeah. So you decide that you've obviously got some concern and some compassion from stateside, but then you decide, and Oxfam, in hearing about your work, decides with you that you should go over there. Would you characterize yourself as a pretty privileged young man from here in Massachusetts, would you?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. And so what was it like to see the thing that you'd been concerned about from afar?
Well, it was something I was hoping to do for a long time. And although I had some expectations, it was nothing that I could have prepared myself for. And it was really an amazing experience in many ways.
What struck you? I mean, we've seen the images from afar of thousands of people in refugee camps and people trudging for miles from their villages that have been destroyed by the Janjaweed and the Arab militia. What was it that, you know, when you saw it in person, what jumped out?
Most of all, the resilience of the people there in Darfur. Everyone is very motivated to get back on track, rebuild their homes, rebuild their communities. And they all have plans that they wanted to present to me about how they could go forward with these kinds of things.
We have some pictures. And by the way, you can see them at our website, here-now.org. What am I looking at here, for instance? It looks like an American Indian village with a backdrop of, you know, a mountain range. What am I looking at?
Yeah, it sort of reminded me of pueblos, actually. It's the landscape looking out from a small village in northern Darfur. During the rainy season, it's more lush, but it can often turn very arid, and there's some water problems. There's not enough water.
Here's a group of women. I mean, beautiful white cloth wrapped around their heads, striking bright blue outfits against this blue painted wall. It looks so cheery, but I don't imagine that's really the story behind the picture.
Well, those are actually their secondary school uniforms that they're required to wear. And I was lucky enough to get to speak with these young women, despite sort of the gender barriers of and religious restraints there.
What did they say to you? Were their concerns?
They echoed many of the concerns of the young men. They want more training. They want things as small as more balls for their schoolyard so they can play different sports.
Yeah. Here you're shaking a hand with a young man and behind him another young man holding a baby. Do many of the teenagers find themselves in the position of being caregivers for younger kids? We've heard about so many orphans.
Well, not necessarily their children, but a lot of the families there are very big. 5, 6, 7 children is not uncommon at all. So a lot of the older members of the family, 15, 16, 17, become caregivers for some of the younger siblings.
Right. How was that for you to see? I mean, here, American kids can get online, they can blog, they can get their voice out. You know, it's this extraordinary time for young people. And then you meet these kids in Darfur who can't.
Well, the young people in Darfur certainly would love to have more of a voice. It's something that I heard a lot. Most of their representation is by older leaders known as umdas. And they really want to have some kind of representation in their local communities, local governments. Seeing through their eyes is something that was very important to me. And developing programs for them is certainly a big issue.
Nick, thanks.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
18-year-old Nick Anderson of Conway, Massachusetts, co-founder of Dollars for Darfur, a national online fundraising challenge for American high schoolers, now also a youth ambassador for Oxfam America. He's just returned from Darfur. To see his pictures and video from that trip and for information about his efforts, go to our website, here-now.org. And also, don't forget that while there, you can download a podcast. Take us with you wherever you go. Here's a question to think about. What movie are you embarrassed to say that you love? Well, we're going to ask our film critics that question And we'll have that before we go today as well. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, it's time again for our occasional, very occasional series on guilty pleasures. The things you do, you'd die if anyone knew. In the past, we've looked at embarrassing musical favorites. Mine was the one-hit wonder, Into the Night. Today's genre, films. Films you only want to watch when there's no one else around. Not those kinds of films. We're talking about films that might be considered too lowbrow, too highbrow, too violent, too juvenile. I sometimes look around to see I'm enjoying the latest animated film more than the kids in attendance. Hey, Rats as Chefs? That was brilliant. So what's your guilty pleasure? We thought we'd pose that question to two people whose tastes we usually hold in the highest esteem. Here now is pop culture critic Renee Graham. Hello, Renee.
Hi, Robin.
And Boston Globe movie critic Ty Burr. Nice to see you as well, Ty.
Thanks, Robin.
Renee, let's start with you because this idea started when you were in a while back with songs that were guilty pleasures. And you said at the time, songs that, you know, you're sort of embarrassed you love, one thing, but guilty pleasure films, a whole new level of embarrassment. Why?
A song lasts, what, 2-3 minutes at best? But when you're watching a movie that most people consider bad, you're investing 2 hours of your life, and you're doing it again and again and again. It's those films that you're getting ready to walk out the door, you see it's on, and you sit down and watch the whole bloody thing.
Right, right. And we said this before, Ty, one person's trash, another person's treasure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So let's take a look at some of your choices. Both of you have romances on your lists. Renee, Falling in Love. You start with this film. It's a 1984 film starring Robert De Niro and Meryl Streep as these New York commuters, Connecticut too, who fall in love on a train. And I remember there was a lot of sort of outcry at the time over this film. Remind us why.
I think the issue was people heard Robert De Niro and Meryl Streep, even though they had worked together before in The Deer Hunter, people wanted just an acting clinic. And it's a very quiet film about two very ordinary people who meet on a commuter train and fall in love, even though they're both married.
They're
to
married.
Other people.
That was part of the you know, outcry. They're married.
Oh, it's Brief Encounter all over again.
Exactly. But there are certain moments in the film that are so pitch perfect about when you meet someone and what you're trying to do and wearing the right clothes and saying the right thing. That film has always been very, very dear to me. And even though people always say, it's boring, that film was not boring. I absolutely love that movie, and I dare say I get a little choked up at the end every time.
I remember the scene where Meryl Streep was in front of a mirror. I'll never forget this, trying to pick up the
clothes
to wear. That's
the best scene, and the scene plays out over about 2 or 3 minutes at this Dave Grusin music in the background, and she's just trying on different outfits for her first real kind of date with Robert De Niro. And she's trying on the hats, and she's flouncing around as she would when she sees him, and then she finally stops and goes, "What are you doing?
Yeah.
What are you doing?" That scene is so real to me, and who hasn't had that moment?
What are you doing?
Ty, you have a couple. Untamed Heart. This is
Yes, also known as the Christian Slater Baboon Heart movie.
Because this is the Christian Slater, Marissa Tomei film about the love affair between a busboy and a waitress.
Yes.
And a baboon? What's with the baboon in there?
The Christian Slater busboy character is convinced he has had a heart transplant and has a baboon's heart in his chest. You never really find out whether that's true or not, but he's this oddball character that gets Marissa Tomei's world-weary waitress to fall in love with him because he represents innocence and true love, and it's one of these sappy early 90s romantic chick flick dramas that people scorned, people spurned, people laughed at. Damn it, every time it comes on, I'm sitting there with just bawling like a baby.
What's the appeal?
I respect a movie that's willing to sail off the edges of believability in the pursuit of romance and true love. If it really believes in that and it isn't just a pose, you gotta go with it.
You don't have to love me back. I'm gonna give you my heart. Okay.
a scene from 1993's Untamed Heart, during which Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr can be found sniffling. We're also speaking with Here Now pop culture critic Renee Graham. When we come back, more romance, cheesy adventures, and a couple of actors Ty and Renee just have to watch after a break Here and Now. It's Here and Now with our pop culture critic Renee Graham and Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. The topic today, guilty pleasure, the film division, those movies that you'd be just too embarrassed to admit you like. Ty, romances. Last year's film, The Lake House, is one of your picks. I only know it from the ads. Somehow Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock are involved in some sort of time travel in a lake house.
Oh, it's one of these completely silly time fragment movies that have been hip in the last 10 years where they live in the same house, yet they're 2 years apart. And somehow she puts a letter for him in the mailbox, and he gets it 2 years earlier, and yet they correspond. It's completely dish-headed. It's completely silly.
You might not remember, but we saw each other. At least I saw you. You never told me how beautiful you were.
Well, maybe you saw somebody else. That was a bad hair year for me.
Long brown hair, gentle, unguarded eyes.
Okay. You saw me. But I still don't know what you look like.
Well, why don't we just get together in the future and you can let me know what you think?
For one thing, I love Sandra Bullock movies. I know they get no respect. They're like potato chips. You know, you can just sit there and watch it. And Keanu Reeves, especially with her, I think I wrote in the review, they're like the Black Labs of movie stars. They're like, you know, they're both kind of sheepish and shaggy and sweet, and they're just fun to watch together. And the movie makes no sense whatsoever, and that's part of the appeal also.
Renee, Keanu Reeves makes an appearance on your list of guilty pleasures. He stars with Patrick Swayze. Dirty Dancing comes to mind, guilty pleasure. In Point Break, as the 1991 film about surfer bank robbers, which I think takes us into the next category, which is called the cheesy adventure flick. Describe your pick.
The cheesy adventure flick. It's not just surfer bank robbers. There's surfer bank robbers who wear masks of ex-presidents, and so they become known as the ex-presidents. They have a Lyndon B. Johnson mask. They have a JFK mask. It's really strange. But here you have Keanu Reeves, who is awful. He is absolutely awful in this movie. Patrick Swayze, with way too much blonde frosting in his hair, is probably even worse.
Everything moves in cycles. So twice a century, the ocean lets us know just how small we really are. A winter storm comes out of Antarctica, tearing up the Pacific. And it sends a huge swell north 2,000 miles. And when it hits Bell's Beach, it'll turn into the biggest surf this planet has ever seen, and I will be there.
So will I.
Yeah! You want the ultimate, you gotta be willing to pay the ultimate price.
But it has a couple of absolutely stunning action sequences, one of which is a foot chase that goes through backyards, through homes. Somebody throws a dog at somebody else. It just goes on and on and on, and you just get into it. Against your best judgment, you get into it.
That might apply as well to the, you know, sort of the cheesy adventure flick of all time, the Poseidon Adventure. You're presenting that as
I
one
will
of your
defend that movie to the
death. I'll back you up on that.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Is this the original?
This is the original, 1972.
We will not speak of the remake.
No. I love that movie so much. When I saw it when I was 10, I actually developed a strange obsession with Ernest Borgnine for about a month.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
It was that deep. I started watching like McHale's Navy reruns after that. I mean, I had this whole thing because he played this New York cop, and that's what the whole thing is. It's a cruise ship, you know, on its way overseas, gets hit by the mother of all tidal waves, capsizes the ship, and everyone has to get out.
There's nobody alive but us, and nobody's going to help us except ourselves. It's up to each one of you. It's up to all of us, together. Now please, for God's sake, come with me.
And that sounds cheesy, but the thing that works about the movie is they play it like Shakespeare. The movie is not played for laughs. No one can ever tell me that is a bad thing. I'm a guilty pleasure because I do not feel guilty about Poseidon Adventure. Thank you.
You take that stand. Mm-hmm. Ty, we have to ask you about a not-so-secret passion of yours. You told us guilty pleasure, anything with Ashley Judd.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the worse the movie it is, the more I'll enjoy it.
You're speaking of Eye of the Beholder.
Eye of the Beholder is one of the most incomprehensible movies I have ever seen in my entire life. I watch it every time it comes on. It's got Ewan McGregor as some sort of government spy who gets obsessed with Ashley Judd, who's a serial killer who also has daddy issues. It's preposterous beyond belief, and yet she plays it totally straight. She is, I believe, the Ida Lupino of her generation, just showing up in these B-movies and playing them as if, as you said, they're Shakespeare.
I've lost my childhood, my youth, my father, my husband. My daughter. She wasn't any bigger than a minute. Barely had a name. Now my mind's going to play tricks on me. And spookiest of all, I lost my angel. I had a guardian who looked after me. I think I miss him the most.
And remember, Renee, we just want to make sure we've touched on the person that's your guilty pleasure, Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Okay, I need to be clear about this. It's the early Jean-Claude Van Damme canon, not the later nonsense like Lionheart. I mean the early cheap films like Kickboxer and Bloodsport. You know, I grew up in New York, and if you grew up in New York, you spend a lot of time cutting school to go down to 42nd Street to watch kung fu movies. And once you've got that in your system, you're always going to enjoy a martial arts films. And that's what those films are early on. He was an actual European champion before becoming sort of an actor. And he doesn't have to really act in these movies. All he has to do is look absolutely beautiful. He's in incredible physical shape, and he has to kick a lot of people around, and that he does. He does these wonderful 360 roundhouse kicks, these splits. I can watch those movies for hours.
Renee, you've been a culture critic for years. Ty, a film critic whose opinions are often quoted nationally, Entertainment Weekly. Is this something that, is there pressure on you as critics when you're doing your professional work to sort of convey that you're a little more, what's the word, highfalutin?
Erudite.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Elitist, perhaps. I do think that there's a segment of the readership that expects us to take the artistic high road and to point out those films that are worthier, that are more culturally valuable, when in fact a lot of us, almost all of us, go to see movies to be transformed, to be lifted up by stories, to be taken somewhere else, to maybe use our brains but also use, you know, our heart and our spirit, and sometimes just to be entertained by junk. And I think a critic that doesn't admit to the pleasures of junk isn't doing his or her job completely.
Does renowned chef Todd English probably eat at his local pizza joint? I'm sure he does.
Todd
does Mario Batali go to Dunkin' Donuts? Look at him. I'm guessing he probably does. There's nothing wrong with liking what you like. You know, it's fine to have these sort of tastes like, oh, I'm a critic and I have to like this, but the bottom line, what you're entertained by is what you're entertained by. Right. I don't think you need to excuse that.
Right, and if you
that.
Don't admit to that somewhere in your criticism, then you're not doing your job.
Exactly.
There you have it, our occasional continuing series on guilty pleasures. We've been speaking with Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr and here now pop culture critic Renee Graham about their guilty film pleasures. By the way, if you've got some, send them to us here-now.org. I think we covered a lot of ground. Ty, Renee, thanks as always.
Thank you.
There's got to be a morning after. If we can hold on through the night, we have a chance to find the sunshine. Let's keep on looking for the love.
Everybody sing. What, you were expecting the theme from Bloodsport? Mais non. Maureen McGovern's theme from The Poseidon Adventure won an Oscar for Best Song, which instantly elevates it, don't you think? Okay, we've heard from a couple of you. Bruce Campbell writes his guilty pleasure, Dude, Where's My Car, with Ashton Kutcher. That's not embarrassing much. And then we also have heard from Linda Keenan, her two favorites, Yentl, and The Jazz Singer with Neil Diamond, of course. Oh, what a shame. We don't have any Neil Diamond to play for you now. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.